This is In the Arms of Morpheus. Danceless Brass the Morphe. A Sandman fanfic rated for teen and up audiences, featuring the relationship Dream of the Endless and Hov Gatling, as well as the characters Death of the Endless and the Jessamy the Raven. It is tagged for Hurt Comfort, Alternative Universe, Canon Divergence, Friends to Lovers, Emotional Hurt Comfort, Canon Typical Violence, Slow Burn, First Kiss, Light Angst, Romance, Love Confessions, Hov Saves a Dream, Alcohol. Death comes for a bird. Jessamy, her name is. She knows all of their names, even if most of those who get her gifts don't have ones that can be spoken by a human. This one, though, is special. As she appears in the basement of an estate in Winch Cross, expecting nothing special, she stops in her tracks, a scene before her captivating and too shocking to process all at once. A metal-encased glass ball with a circle of cold runic writing around it and a splash of red on the glass. A man, naked, reaching out, his face obscured by the bloody stain from where she observes. A bird's corpse, disfigured, on the stone floor. A young man, rifle in his hands. Three more around him, agitated. The violence of it doesn't disturb her. She's seen enough of it to accept it as part of her job, almost ever present in her wake. It is the peculiarity of it that gives her pause. Jessamy's soul, the part of her she is here for, is still flapping her wings, trying to peck the glass open, not realizing that she doesn't possess the beak to do so any longer. A young man comes to pick up her corpse, gentle. He makes brief eye contact with the man behind the glass, then carries it away. Ignores the guy who offers him a bucket to throw it into. The remaining men exchange a look, say something about the fire and exit, presumably to deal with the problem at hand. Death is left alone with the bird and the man in the orb. The wings beat against the glass. She sighs. Come now, Jessamy, she says gently and moves closer. Stop, the man says in her brother's voice. She does, more out of surprise than anything else. No living creature on this plane should sound that way, except for one, and if he was here, she would feel his presence. Death takes a step to the side to have a better look at the strange man, and gasps, her hand coming up to her face in a gesture so human, even she doesn't expect it of herself. In all her years, she hasn't seen him in such a state. Dream, she whispers and reaches out towards him, but her fingers freeze as a thought crosses her mind. She looks at the writings on the floor. When she raises her gaze back at him again, their eyes meet, hers wide with realization, his red-rimmed and glistening with grief and helpless rage. And just like that, she knows exactly what happened. She also knows she cannot cross the line of the writing, or else she might be captured too. Her brother has just saved her from it. Dream breaks eye contact with her. Stiffly, he reaches out towards his raven's soul, touches the glass gently, his expression unreadable. "Jessamy," he says, barely audible, a request implied in his tone. The bird doesn't listen. Instead, her movement becomes even more erratic. "Please," he says, even quieter. The bird flies to the floor, sits in front of the glass cage, her feet wet with her own blood as she hops closer, looking at him. There's an air of desperation around her, even though she is silent. "Thank you, my friend," Dream says, bending down to see her better. "Your sacrifice will not be forgotten." Jessamy calls at him softly. "You deserve peace," he tells her. "I relieve you of your duties as my friend and assistant. And as my last request of you, I ask, go with my sister. She has a gift to give you." The bird flaps her wings stubbornly. Dream closes his eyes minutely. "My well-being should not concern you any longer. I am begging you to go," he whispers without looking at his raven. Jessamy looks at him for a few moments longer, waiting for him to change his mind. Then, hesitantly, she hops out of the circle, flies to settle on Death's readily outstretched arm. "Thank you, brother," she says quietly. If the bird didn't exit the circle, she wouldn't be able to give her gift. Dream helped his sister, even though it hurt him visibly. He doesn't respond, doesn't even look at her, his body still and unmoving. Death saw him hurt before. Never quite so much. She considers finding a piece of furniture to drag across the writings and break the circle, considers helping him out of his cage, but the laws are clear, unless he asks, specifically, unless he invites her to meddle in his affairs. It is prohibited. "I'm sorry," she tells him. She turns to Jessamy. "Don't worry, dear. It will be all right. I know just the place for you." With that, they are both gone. A thin pale of being is left in a vast, dark basement, alone with the blood of his friend still staining the glass that entraps him. He closes his eyes and lets tears fall from his lashes freely, the trembling in his hands barely visible as his shoulders slump in a moment of weakness allowed to him by a rare, cold minute of privacy. In 1926, Hofgatling is in Prague. No point in being effectively immortal if you don't go around seeing places, if only to try their foods and the spirits, he reasons. He is sitting in one of the city's many pubs, drinking what is, as the barman has assured him, the best damn beer in Czechoslovakia. It is, admittedly, really quite good. He chugs it and puts his empty glass down. "This, my friend, is why I'll never tire of living," he tells the barman in English, since he couldn't be bothered to learn such, just for this. Even immortals have priorities. The barman nods unenthusiastically, then goes back to cleaning beer taps. Is it now? A stranger says behind Hov in a friendly tone, in perfect English, and Hov turns to see her with a wide smile. A beautiful, dark-skinned lady is standing next to him, her eyes mischievous, her clothes suggesting she comes from money, but not so much money she would be annoying to deal with. The city's beautiful architecture and pleasant encounters with its people in combination with nice weather and really good beer have put Hov in a jolly mood, so he tips his hat to her and offers her a seat beside him. She takes it. Robert Goldring at your service, he says pleasantly.
Would you like something from the bar?
She smiles at him. I know who you are, Hov. She says. He frowns. In his experience, these words usually mean either opportunity or trouble, and since he doesn't remember any beautiful ladies like her, and considering his unfortunate history in the 1700s, he smells more problem than coin. She sees his wariness and chuckles, delightful and charismatic. You may relax, sir. I am not here to cause you any trouble. We've met before, although we weren't introduced. You are, however, quite familiar with my brother.
Oh,
he says, and doesn't relax at all.
This is a lucky meeting, then. I don't frequent Prague.
He raises his glass.
Who's your brother?
A gentleman you've known for quite some time. Tall, pale, black hair and clothes. Meets you once a century, she says, and grins as his jaw slackens in realization.
Oh, he repeats, that bastard has a sister, huh?
Hov wasn't even sure if he was actually born instead of created, so this, at least, clarifies that for him. Not that it helps much at all, of course.
Yes, I think I know the one.
The woman raises a hand and gestures at the barman to get them two more of what Hov's been having. In fact, I've come because you are the only human associate of him I know of, she says to Hov. You've got a friendly relationship, don't you? Hov blinks at her. He thinks about it for a moment, then nods.
I thought so, he says. I tried to bring it up with him, but he stormed out at a mere suggestion that we might be friends. That's how we parted last time I saw him.
The woman rolls her eyes. Forgive my brother, she says. He can be unbearably stubborn sometimes, I admit. But, she looks at Hov, do you consider yourself his friend? Hov nods, maybe a little too quickly. I do. In all fairness to him, it's not a question, really. When you are immortal, people seem to die so frequently. On your darker days, you start questioning if it is worth it to build connections at all. This vampiric-looking man was the only constant, the only person Hov knew who likely wouldn't die before him, which, on days Hov lost another friend or lover, made him seem like the only acquaintance worth giving a damn about at all, no matter that they've only met 6 times before this. Besides,
It is one thing to find a good shag or a good conversation party or a reliable mate. It is another to find someone who knows and understands you on a level far outside of a normal person's ability. His friend is not any of the former. After all, he's not really there to be any of those with any significance. But the fact that he is the latter makes him invaluable. Also, Hov is absolutely sure that he was right about the guy wanting companionship, too. A mere idea brought tears to the man's normally, in Hov's experience, brick wall-esque facade, which could be attributed to anger and wounded pride. But hey, Hov has been around for quite some time. He has more than enough experience to recognize what denial looks like. What a man experiences when you take a deep wound of his that he's been trying to ignore and forget about for the sake of his own sanity, and you stick your finger in it. That's what causes this sort of reaction, not mere ego issues. Plus, after all, there are other immortals out there, and his mysterious friend doesn't really ask the question of will to live anymore. So really, the only reason to keep Hov around and keep meeting him is just that, to keep meeting him, nothing else to it. And in Hov's books, that's what friendship is. The barman slides their beers towards them, and Hov drinks, in part to hide behind the glass as the woman studies his expression carefully. He puts the glass down, half empty. The woman nods. In that case, you might want to know that he is in trouble, she says. Hov feels his brows rise as he blinks at her. Him? He asks, the man who can grant you immortality, who is immortal himself, in trouble. Then again, he supposes everyone gets in trouble one way or another. He's had his fair share of bad days, starvation, for one, did not feel good at all. He remembers his friend and his stiff, bird-like demeanor, the way he smiles like he's only allowing himself to do so as a rare treat, the way his presence feels weirdly charged with tension that draws you to pay attention to him. He tries to imagine him hurt, then captured. He decidedly does not like either. In fact, the idea of it gives him a shot of quick, energizing anger that calls him to punch something in the face. He clears his throat instead. Is he all right? He asks. He is not, the woman says firmly. From her tone, Hov makes an assumption that his anger might actually be justified. Can I help? He asks. It feels weird to ask that of a being who is, most likely, more powerful than he can imagine. Still, she wouldn't have come here, wouldn't have said all of this if she didn't need him in some way. She considers him. He is held captive by a human magician, she says. I cannot intervene, but you, a human, can do whatever you like. So, she reaches into her purse and pulls out a piece of paper. When Hov examines it, he finds that it has an address written on it. You might like to visit here, erase the golden rooms, and break the glass that holds him. I imagine he can handle the rest. Hov wants to ask why she wouldn't be able to erase some runes and crack some windows as he imagines the glass to be, then chooses not to bother. It is probably too complicated for him anyway. Some esoteric reasoning or other he would maybe understand in theory, but not comprehend in its entirety or whatever. So instead, he chooses to look at the piece of paper again. "It's in London," he says. "It will take some time to get back there." "Then better get to it," the woman winks at him. "What I mean is," Hov insists, "if it's a question of life and death that has to be resolved on a time constraint, I should probably know so I can plan a mission. You understand?" Judging by the symptoms this world suffers from his absence, I think my brother has been captive for about 10 years already, she tells him, and Hov breathes in sharply. 10 years? What the fuck? I don't think a day or two will make a difference in terms of life and death. But if you saw him, you would understand that even an hour is too much. "Right," he says. She downs her beer in one go, impressive, nods at him with a smile, gets up, and turns to leave. He's quick to stop her, though, because his curiosity couldn't kill him if he tried. "A question, if I may." She looks at him. "What's your name?" It is a petty thing to ask, of course, but he has to try, if only for the hope of getting enough information to deduce who her brother really is. She cocks her head, considering. She looks amused. "I'll let my brother tell you that," she decides. "Be seeing you, Hov Gatling." "Be seeing?" He blinks, and she's not there anymore. "You," he finishes lamely. He looks at the address again, then drinks the rest of his beer and places money on the counter. "Thanks," he says to the barman. "I'll be off now. I think I've got a train to catch." Next time Death sees her brother is in a month since their last meeting, when Roderick Burgess dies. It is almost poetic how similar the scene before her is to the one she saw last time she was here. She doesn't stay long this time. Roderick is unpleasant to deal with, even in death. He tries to chant his magic at her, tries to beg when it is futile, curses his son with life filled with bitterness and failure. Death makes as quick a work of leading him away as she can manage. She does return in an hour, when she has a moment of free time, half hoping that the cage might already be empty at that point. It isn't. Dream still sits within it, unnaturally still, even for him, and as she approaches, he raises his gaze at her. It is full of cold, barely contained rage. She does not blame him. "How are you, brother?" she asks. He doesn't answer, just narrows his eyes at her. She nods. I thought so, she says. I thought I'd cheer you up a bit and tell you that help is on the way. He frowns at her.
Help?
He asks, raspy, his voice unused to speaking. You know, I can't deal with this for you, Dev says, gesturing widely at his predicament. I am not the only one who gives two shits about it, though. Dream looks genuinely confused.
I don't understand,
he says. Death smiles at him. Luckily, you don't have to. It takes Hofgadling 2 months to get back in London, figure out how to get into the estate, and to actually perform his plan. He would be quicker if everything stopped going wrong just for a day, maybe, but apparently not with his luck. His plan, at first, is to sneak into the estate unnoticed when Roderick Burgess is out of town, since he might take some of the guards with him and leave the estate vulnerable. Soon, Hof realizes that apparently Roderick Burgess is virtually never out of town, which has him swearing, drinking strong liquor in a bar, and thinking very hard for the next 2 weeks. His next plan is to become Roderick's friend so that the man might let him into the house himself. He even manages to meet him once. They have a nice conversation about older literature, and that has Hof getting his hopes up. Unfortunately, Roderick Burgess dies right about this time, and his son closes the estate for all visitors, saying that he needed time to grieve his father. Hof gets into a bar brawl just to let off steam because of that. In the end, he infiltrates the guard. He spends a month becoming pub friends with one of the men who work at the estate and whines extensively about how he is an ex-soldier and how he needs a job as soon as possible and how he knew Roderick. Yeah, they've met once. Such a shame. All that magic stuff is so interesting. He wishes he could have seen at least one magic trick. Then, on a separate occasion, he follows another one of those men into a dark alleyway and breaks his collarbone in a fake rubbing, thus creating a job offer he receives the very next day. He doesn't expect to see what he does in that basement. His buff buddy is explaining to him how he shouldn't ever come in for work tired or go near the glass, ever. The guy says reassuring things about how he's been doing this for 6 years and that the thing hasn't done much at all, so there's no point in being scared of it. Hof doesn't listen to any of that. He stares at the unmoving, unnaturally bent, thin figure at the bottom of what looks like a giant metal-encased Christmas ornament. He is strikingly naked. In his times of weakness, Hof has, in fact, wondered what his fellow immortal might look like without his black clothes. Preferably laid out on the table of the inn, where they usually meet, or pushed up against the wall, or writhing in bed.
Hove isn't ashamed of those thoughts. The man is handsome, and his way of holding himself does provoke thought of what might make his usual strictness turn to passion. He just hopes that his mysterious benefactor isn't omniscient. And now, here he is, naked and laid out, but the only desire Hove feels is to take his coat off and to wrap his friend in it, give him at least some dignity, give him some warmth. God, the basement is chilly, and even as an immortal, Hove wouldn't risk sitting on cold glass with his bare ass for fear of getting a nasty illness of some sort. The way he lays there, the way everything around him seems so uncomfortable and hostile towards him, all of it strips his nakedness of any sexuality and makes him look even more like an inhuman trapped spider-like creature. Hove thinks about how he hasn't known his acquaintance to show any skin other than hands and face. He thinks about how proud his friend is, how ambiguously powerful, about how he acted offended by a human accusing him of wanting a mortal's friendship. This must be torture for him in so many different ways. 10 years of it. Hove Gatling wants to kill so many people at that moment, but as a man who's lived a long life and seen many betrayals and vengeances, he knows that he's not the one who should be picking their punishments. His friend doesn't look at Hove or his companion. He stares off into a distance, somewhere to his left, his expression stiff and full of quiet, well-worn hatred.
"He's like that literally every day," Hove's co-guard says. "Barely moves."
They are alone here, Hove and his drinking buddy. Hove waits until the door closes behind them, and he is sure that they are pretty well isolated, sound-wise, before he puts his soldering experience to good use once again and knocks the guy out. It's not easy, he has to fight for it, and if he is honest with himself, it feels absolutely amazing to finally punch this whole situation in the teeth and kick it in its balls with all the gusto it deserves. And yes, Hove fights dirty when it comes to punching kidnappers of his dearest friends. He manages to do it fast and furious enough because his opponent doesn't get a chance to make too much noise, and when he's done, he doesn't hear any footsteps from outside the door, which means he has time to do what he's here to do. When he turns to the Arv, his friend is already standing up and looking at him, his gaze intense, a leashed cat ready to pounce the moment its prey gets within range. Their eyes meet. Hove's never seen genuine surprise on his face, and he will treasure the memory of it for all the years that are left to him.
"Hove Gatling,"
his friend whispers, wonder airy in his voice.
"Good to see you, dear fellow,"
Hove says cheerfully and picks a gun from his unfortunate puff buddy's unconscious body.
"Move aside, will you?"
It takes all 6 bullets to break the glass enough for it to shatter. Hove hears agitated voices from behind the door, makes eye contact with his friend, and wipes away part of the magic circle with his foot.
Can you get out of here on your own?
Huff asks as he shrugs out of his coat and offers it to the man who is standing in the remnants of his prison, looking at it with an unreadable expression on his face. His friend looks at him. His eyes are red-rimmed and the glistening, and the kaleidoscope of emotion there is fleeting but so intense Huff almost wants to look away to give him privacy. He is too slow, though. His friend is already looking at the unconscious man on the floor, and suddenly there is sand in his hand, just in time, too. The door of the basement opens, and there are six men with guns pouring in, ready to shoot. Alex Burgess is in the back, looking confused and worried. They all get sand blown into their eyes, and they all fall asleep right there on the floor.
"You should go, Huff,"
his friend says, taking Huff's offered coat and draping it over narrow, pale shoulders.
"This is not your fight any longer, and it never should have been."
Huff grins at him.
"Thank me later,"
he says, half joking.
"I will,"
his friend says, almost solemn.
"And apologize later. You have my word."
"All right," Huff agrees.
"Are you sure you'll be fine on your own?"
His friend gives him a rare smile.
"Quite," he says. "I will find you once I've dealt with the more pressing matters at hand."
"Great," Huff says. "Be seeing you, then."
With that, he gets the hell out of the state, and then out of London altogether. They meet again in 3 days. Curiously enough, his friend finds him in a pub. Not that Huff's got a problem with alcohol or anything. He simply likes beer and considers pubs to be good places to hang out at if you're comfortable with the crowd that frequents them. This time, he's drinking ale for old time's sake. He doesn't particularly expect his fellow immortal being to come loom over him, so when he notices, he almost chokes on his drink. His friend smiles, almost mischievous.
"Huff Gatling,"
he says.
"May I buy you a drink?"
Huff must say, although it is a surprise to meet him like this, seeing the man dress comfortably and smiling is much more of a relief than he could have expected himself to feel at the sight. He kicks a chair from under the table, offering the seat to his wayward acquaintance.
"Never said no to that in my life. Not starting now."
He grins. His friend sits, and although he is definitely in good humor, he also seems tense, in a weirdly nervous way only an ancient, barely human being can be. It doesn't really show on his face or in his movements. It is more of a feeling in the air around him. Huff flags the water down and orders 2 more ales.
"Dealt with all the pressing matters, I take it?"
he asks when the lad scurries away. His friend nods stiffly.
"Most," he says. "There is much to be done, still. But the damage is far less than it could have been had you not done what you did. I owe you much."
Huff considers him,
his thoughts straying towards tales of people helping gods and fae and asking for things in return. He then thinks of an ancient being in a glass orb, demeaned, stripped of his power, helplessly furious. He thinks of the longing he feels every time he speaks to a person and finds no points of connection, finds that his experience is lonely and incomprehensive to anyone but his raven-like once a century date. Who did Hav do this for, truly? Sure, his friend obviously benefited, but if he's honest, truly honest, didn't he do it for himself? Took back something that could have been taken from his life, provided himself with companionship, got his prize, in a form of the possibility to talk to someone who won't be dead in 20 years.
That drink's enough, Hav decides.
It is not, his friend says. But this debt will be repaid in full. I will see to it.
Hav looks at him and smirks. I have an idea, he says. How about you buy me a drink every time we meet, until that debt of yours feels like it's run out?
His friend narrows his eyes at him, cocks his head like a human wouldn't. Do you wish to bind me to yourself, Hav Gatling? He asks.
Hav rolls his eyes. Jesus, no, that's not what I meant, he says, because just he does want that on a deeply selfish level, if only to save himself from a deep ache of loneliness that sometimes gets the better of him. Still, that doesn't mean he would ever act upon it. Look, what I'm trying to say is... I didn't do it to get a reward of some sort. I did it because you were in trouble, and that didn't sit well with me, so I had to do something. I just want us to keep meeting like we did before, that's all. The being across the table leans away and looks at him with a mixture of muted wonder and delight.
You surprise me, my friend, he says, as if he hasn't said anything significant, as if Hav is not imagining himself doing a little victorious dance when the word leaves him. Hav is sure there is a satisfied, irritating little smirk on his face. His companion doesn't seem to be bothered by it.
I did not imagine you could possess such nobility, he says.
Hav huffs.
Nobility is a sham, he says. I simply like to keep up a habit.
His friend hums neutrally. The waiter brings them their drinks. Hav slides one towards his companion.
I owe you an apology, at least,
the man says.
The way we last parted was in bad taste.
Saying what I said was in bad taste, too, Hav shrugs. I say we are even.
Still, his friend says, as a gesture of goodwill, I will make sure your nightmares leave you be. I know you have a few.
Hav blinks at him.
How?
He asks. His friend smiles at him, lifts his chin, proud and composed and a little mischievous.
I am Morpheus, he says in that inhuman voice of his. Dream of the endless. I contain the collective subconscious within me. Hopes and the dreams are what my realm and I are made of. Yours and everyone else's. Freeing your nights of nightmares is not a hard task for one such as I.
Hov blinks at him. Did he see a literal god naked? Did he save an actual deity? He smiles weakly and then raises his glass. To finally putting a name to the face, he toasts, his voice a little uneven.
The god of dreams picks up his glass and returns the gesture and takes a tentative sip. Just a normal night in the life of Hov Gatling. Hov drinks his ale, feeling lighthearted. Then again, looking at his friend, Morpheus, he does seem like someone you would see in a disturbing, bizarre dream. Not quite right to be human, too thin, too pale, too spindly, his hair a mess, his eyes reflective like a cat's. Hov thinks about the sudden rush of cursed cases of the sleepy sickness that swept the world some 10 years ago.
So all those people, he says, were sick because you were captured?
Morpheus nods, puts down his glass, apparently unimpressed by what this pub has to offer.
Like I said, he reiterates, I owe you much.
Huh, Hov says. He decides to wrap his head around accidentally saving thousands, if not millions, of people across the world a bit later. Maybe he could find a homeless person, give them food and money, and tell them this crazy story just to take it off his chest. So far, he's found that the homeless don't really care that you sound like a lunatic, as long as the food is fresh and you are not being threatening. Halfspinder, he knows why that is. Once you look and smell a certain way, people stop treating you like a person. And when someone does, you don't really give a shit if they are right in the head. You are just glad they are willing to bother. God, he hates remembering those times. He is so fucking glad he chose to keep living. He drinks his ale, trying to shove the thoughts back where they came from. He looks at his companion.
Should I call you Morpheus then?
That is one of my names. His friend nods, as well as Onirus and many other, but those who know me call me Dream.
Should I? Hov asks.
You've more than earned the right, Dream says.
Hov imagines patting himself on the back. Good going, buddy. You know a god. The queen is sleeping in his house? Come suck it. He's got a new achievement of a lifetime to be weirded out by.
So, do I see you in 1989 or in 2026 next? Hov asks. Dream considers it. If I were to pay off my debt of drinks, it would do us better to meet more frequently, he says slowly, carefully. There is much to repay, after all.
Hov grins at him. I would be happy to see you whenever you feel like dropping by, he assures his companion.
I will remember this. Dream nods, and if you wish to see me, say so out loud. I will come in the waking world, or later in your dreams, if I am otherwise occupied.
We have a deal, Hov says, and raises his glass. To many more peaceful meetings, my friend. It feels good to call him that out loud. Dream raises his glass as well, and even takes a sip again, though he clearly doesn't like the drink. Hov feels like, out of all the things he could have asked for as a reward for his grand rescue mission, the fact that there is some ale foam on Dream's upper lip when he puts the glass down, that absolutely takes the cake. There is a stray thought in his head about licking the foam off. Hov pretends he didn't have it, and hopes Morpheus can't read waking minds, as he probably can the dreaming ones. Hov doesn't expect to see his friend for at least a year before they meet again. Instead, the familiar thin dark silhouette frequents the outskirts of his dreams. He is not there every night, only maybe once a month, but given their previous arrangement, that is still a lot, to say the least. He disappears every time Hov catches a glimpse of him. Weirdly, Hov finds his presence reassuring. His dreams are pleasant and refreshing, as promised. He usually finds himself in courtrooms and gardens, beautiful states and jolly warships. The food is always wonderful, and the drinks are soft and vibrant. His friends, past and present, are happy to hug and exchange latest gossip. He never runs out of coin. If he dreams of battle, it is always painless and fun, and nobody dies. It feels like he is being spoiled rotten. He used to be indifferent to going to sleep. Now he looks forward to it, almost as much as he looks forward to being awake again. Sometimes, though, sometimes he sees a very particular door. He doesn't pay much attention to it, at first, writing it off as just a weird detail his imagination decided to use, for no particular reason at all. But after the fourth time he notices it, he must admit it is a pattern. It's not there every night, though, so it takes a few weeks for it to appear again, before he can do what he has decided to do. He is in the middle of an invigorating chat with one of his acquaintances that he knew sometime around the 1500s, when he notices it again. He could have sworn it wasn't there a minute ago, but now that it is there, well... Hov gets up from his comfy sofa, ignoring his companion's laughter at his own bad joke. Sorry, Samuel, I'm afraid I have to see to something important. He says. He knows what this door is. He suspects where it leads. It is still unpleasant to find out he is right. The glass is empty this time. Dream is stood outside of it, fully clothed, hands clasped behind his back, the expression unreadable. He stares at the arv and at his reflection in it,
pondering, just like last time they were here. He doesn't see Hav come in. "Having fun?" Hav asks, approaching. Just like last time, Dream looks at him in surprise and confusion. The expression is less pronounced, but still worth stashing away in the collection of faces Hav Gatling made a god make by being a nosy asshole. "You shouldn't be here, Hav," Dream says, watching Hav walk towards him to stop at his side.
"Neither should you,"
Hav says.
"What do you have to gain from staring at it?"
"That is of no concern to you," Dream says.
"Is it?"
Hav asks. "Because I think you want me here."
"I do not,"
Dream says, his voice deepening, a warning.
"Then why is there a door in Samuel's estate that leads here?"
Hav asks. Dream looks at the aforementioned door like he's just noticing it for the first time.
"You said the dreams are you, in a way,"
Hav says.
"Maybe part of you was hoping I would walk in here so much it created a way for that to happen," he doesn't say, but heavily implies. For a moment, Dream looks like he's going to kick him out, somehow. Instead, he breathes out slowly and turns back to the orb.
"You annoy me,"
he says gravely.
Hav smirks, satisfied.
"So, why are you here?" he asks, because if someone calls you annoying, you either back off or become infuriating, and Hav is not one to back down easily. Dream doesn't respond right away. When he does, it is quiet.
"I don't understand how he managed to do this,"
he says.
"Roderick?" Hav asks.
"Humans should not possess such knowledge,"
Dream says, his gaze lowering to the writings on the floor.
"For them to contain one of the endless is unheard of."
Hav drags his foot through the writing, wiping a bit away. He doesn't like it intact, even if it is just a non-functional replica.
"Do you have enemies who could have given good old Rod a book or two?" he asks. Not that he is trying to participate in this. All he wants to do is make sure his friend is not having some weird problems with moving on from this mess of a situation. Dream, however, frowns, his gaze fixed on the disturbed bit of the runic circle. He is quiet for some time. Hav waits. He considers going out to fetch a chair or something. He opts not to, in case his friend decides to lock the door behind him.
"And how did you find me, Hav Gatling?"
Dream asks, still looking down.
"Your sister found me first,"
Hav says. Dream looks at him, frown deepening, eyes narrowed.
"Yehai, big hair, charismatic, dark skin, knows we used to meet once a century," he describes dutifully.
"Death, then?"
Dream nods, relaxing just a fraction.
"She did visit me while I was captured."
A charming lady, bright, gentle eyes, good at downing drinks. Hav feels like he might have an aneurysm if he tries to wrap his mind around what her brother just called her. For all intents and purposes, the way Hav sees it, she and the Dream
look like they are doing each other's jobs. Although, maybe, he just doesn't know that much about death. Not that he intends to find out more about it anytime soon. She seemed like she wanted to help, too, Hov says, after he decides to just see her as his friend's sister for now, and have a crisis of world perception later.
She did, Dream says. She found you.
Hov nods. They are quiet for a bit more, Dream staring at the Arv.
Would you care to visit me, in the waking world, as you call it?
Hov asks. Dream looks at him, with a hint of concern in his eyes.
Do you need assistance?
He asks. No, no. Hov shakes his head and smiles. For lunch, I mean, to take your mind off this. He gestures at the orb. Dream's feathers relax a smidge, where Hov didn't notice them growing tense. He glances at the place where Hov's foot made a gap in the writing.
I've much to do,
he says. He doesn't sound certain or set in his ways as he usually is.
Saturday, then,
Hov says, and dares to clap him on the shoulder lightly. It is firm and bony and doesn't budge at all, like he's tried to slap a statue.
Make a window for me. Do you like chicken?
I wouldn't be opposed.
Dream concedes to Hov's utter delight.
It's a date, then, he grins, and wakes up.
Hov doesn't expect much of their dinner, just a friendly get-together with a god, no big deal. He picks out a nice little restaurant, sits at a table on a terrace, orders some wine. The night is pleasantly warm. There is a little orchestra playing in the establishment, so he can hear music, muted by distance and the walls, but still quite beautiful. Morpheus, dream of the endless, you promised to meet me today. Don't make me wait too long, my friend, he says quietly, looking at the moon that peeks out from behind the cloud.
I wouldn't dare.
Dream answers from behind him, making Hov jump a little. He laughs, surprised, but welcomes his companion to sit down, gives him a menu, pours him some wine. Dream looks good. His cheeks are a tad fuller, like he gained a bit of weight since Hov's last seen him in the waking world, right after his captivity ended. A smile makes an appearance in the corners of his lips. His clothes sit well on him, accentuating his frame. Most importantly, he makes an effort to relax, and Hov is there to encourage and enable. He smiles at his friend and proposes to order for the both of them, since he's familiar with the menu. Dream agrees. They don't talk about Roderick Burgess, or glass orbs, or death. Instead, Dream asks to hear about Hov's life, about what humanity is up to these days. He listens, leaning back against his chair, and drinks wine slowly. When Hov mentions literature, Dream asks about William Shakespeare. They talk about his place, about what the world has come to think of them. They switch to gossiping about other authors, then about art. Hov reminisces about the times when artists
philosophers and writers were the most valued people in society. He jokes about how he would still never go back to a time without decent plumbing. After they are done with the dinner, Dream pays, overgenerous. Huff gets up from the table and offers his companion a walk. Dream agrees. They discuss musicians on the way. The thing Huff notices is that his friend seems very composed still, but something in him has softened in a way that Huff's never seen in the past centuries. If he had to put a word to the change, he would probably use a very tentative affection, hidden in the corners of his friend's eyes, in his rare smiles, in the way he is less formal with his movements and the deadpan jokes. Huff can still feel the ever-present tension his companion radiates, but it is different now, less demanding. Huff finds this change wonderful. It suits his friend. Huff wants to see what will come out of it in the following centuries. It is 2 a.m. when they end up at Huff's place of residence. It is a decently sized house in a good area. Multiple bedrooms and all that. He yawns desperately. I'd love to talk some more, my friend, but I have to, well, fall into your arms, as the French say. Huff jokes. Dream's expression turns unreadable at that. Huff laughs.
Don de Brad Murphy.
That's what they say when someone's asleep. He explains. Have you never heard that? Dream lets his lips curve into a smirk.
In that case, good night, Huff Gatling.
He says, almost immediately.
I enjoyed my time with you.
Moonlight casts his features in a light that makes him look even less human than normal. Ethereal, dreamlike, beautiful. Not handsome, not pretty. Beautiful, like a work of art. A wave of tender desire that follows this realization catches Huff off guard. Suddenly, his hands itch to be put on his friend's jaw and the waist, and his lips buzz, expecting to be pressed to another's in a gentle kiss. He almost takes a step forward, but...
You dare.
He smiles and plays off his aborted movements as charming awkwardness, claps his hands behind his back, looks at his friend. Dream watches him, curiosity in his eyes.
See you in my dreams?
Huff asks, cheeky.
Dream smiles.
If you wish, he says.
He bows his head slightly, then walks away, instead of disappearing like his sister. For some reason, Huff finds that endearing. Next time they meet is a surprise. For 2 months, Huff only sees his friend briefly in his dreams, mostly as a familiar shadow on the outskirts of his attention. The door appears only twice, and Huff isn't quick enough to get to it. It disappears as soon as he makes a step towards it. He decides to let it go. He does shout out a suggestion for a dinner once after he sees Dream's silhouette, but weeks go by and his friend doesn't show. Huff shrugs it off. They used to meet once a century. Even if they meet in a year, that will be 100 times sooner than he could expect, anyway. It doesn't take that long, after all.
Hav is having lunch at a nice little restaurant, way less fancy than the one they visited last time. Just a nice clean place to have a good meal. He reads the newspaper and takes a nice long sip of tea, focused on the article about latest Rajal gossip. When he lowers the cup, there is the sound of someone sitting down at his table across from him. He bends his newspaper in half, ready to reprimand the unwanted visitor, only to see Dream across from him. His mood seems darker than a stormy night. He looks like an angry, wet raven. Huff doesn't know what he is likelier to do first, break down crying, or punch through the table. "Good day to you too, my friend," Huff says, pointedly shoving his worry into a deep, dark closet in his heart and shutting the doors behind it. "Good to see you are well." It is sarcasm, which his friend finds endearingly irritating on a good day and outright annoying on a bad one. Dream glares at him, then looks down and breathes slowly.
"Forgive my state," he says quietly, "and my unwelcome visit. I got unpleasant news."
Huff pours himself some more tea, trying to look casual and again not worried at all. "My friend, your visits are always welcome," Huff says, "no matter your state. Do you want some tea? Or wine? Maybe you could tell me what's going on." Dream's jaw sets, stubbornness radiating off him. He looks like a man who's so unused to leaning onto others that now that he's chosen to finally try it, he doesn't particularly know how to go about it, or even why he wants to do so at all. Huff smiles at him. "Or not. We could just eat and drink, and I could tell you what it's been like for these 2 months, if you would like." Dream considers it, and Huff's almost certain that he's going to get up and leave without a goodbye any second. Not that Huff can do anything about that, so he settles for drinking his tea and enjoying the pretty decorations the place has.
"Talk,"
Dream decides, finally, surprisingly, then makes an effort to relax into the back of his chair.
"Please,"
he adds, almost softly, like he's apologizing for being rude. Huff grins and obeys. He talks about his new house and about his wonderful new acquaintances, talks about a business he's considering starting, and about a funny thing that happened to him in 1894. He asks a waiter to bring them wine and something sweet. It arrives shortly. Huff pours them their drink and pushes a plate with an apple pie towards his friend. Dream picks at it, barely eating at all, but slowly, very slowly, he truly relaxes and settles for drinking his wine. In an hour, he looks tired and sad, but no longer on the verge of a mental breakdown. Huff decides to consider it a win. They spend an hour like this, until Huff shuts up for a minute to remember some good light-hearted stories and take a bite of his pie, too. That's when his companion chooses to join the conversation.
"My sibling had a hand in my imprisonment,"
Dream says out of nowhere. Huff chokes on his food.
"Excuse me?"
he asks once he's over his coughing fit, which Dream ignores.
"Why would anyone do this to their brother?"
Dream looks at his wine glass absentmindedly. I rarely understand the reason behind the sire's actions, he says. I simply wish they didn't lead to the deaths of those I cherish. Hove raises his eyebrows at that. It is a detail he hasn't heard of before. Death visited him in his captivity, he said. I'm sorry to hear you lost someone, he says carefully. Dream doesn't answer. He seems more human than Hove has ever seen him before. He's almost vulnerable, much less guarded than usual. Hove looks at his friend and thinks about the way he looked at his own reflection in the glass orb 2 months ago. He wanted Hove's company then, too. What were they like? Hove tries. He's lost his fair share of good people, and the only way he's found to live through the pain is to talk about them, until it doesn't hurt quite as much. Dream is silent for a long time. Hove is sure that he's heard the question and chose to ignore it, so he lets it go, leaves his friend to stare at the wine in his glass. Her name was Jessamy, his friend says, surprising Hove again. She was my raven and a dear friend. Do you have special ravens? He asks carefully. Dream looks at him, almost disgusted, then sighs like he's remembered who he's dealing with. They are my assistants in the waking world and in the dreaming, he says. Jessamy tried to help me. Alex Burgess shot her. They didn't clean the glass for hours. Hove imagines a red splash on the orb. How it must have looked from the inside of it. Dream's reflection, more prominent, where dark blood was smeared. He looks at his friend, eyes fixed on the red wine in his glass that he keeps rotating with his fingers on the table. Hove feels sick. He wants to do very cruel things to those who did this to his friend. He leans forward on his forearms and reaches out across the table to cover Dream's hand with his, stopping the glass rotation. Dream's skin is cold, his hand surprisingly pliant under Hove's. Do you need my help? He asks. Dream frowns, confused. What with? He asks. He doesn't move away. Getting back at your sibling, Hove shrugs. Punishing those responsible. Asking your sister to bring the raven back. Anything, really. Dream stares at him, surprised. His lips slightly open. Hove notices they are glistening with wine. He pushes his gaze back up to meet his friends and finds gentle wonder and subtle delight where there was fury an hour ago. Would you do that for me? Dream asks. Even without a reward. Hove barks a laugh and takes his companion's long fingers into his hand properly, squeezes them in reassurance. My friend, punching the one who did that to you is a reward of its own, Hove says, jolly. And your sister's a good drinking companion. I don't see why I wouldn't want to have a beer with her. Dream holds eye contact for a few moments more, his eyes searching,
Then his gaze softens and the corners of his lips rise in a rare smile.
I wouldn't ask that of you, he says and squeezes Hov's hand back. But I thank you nonetheless.
Hov nods. He doesn't see a reason to insist on meeting death or punching someone as powerful as her or his friend. He's still got some sense of self-preservation left. Instead, he points at Dream's abandoned wine glass.
How about I order us some whiskey instead of that? He asks. Might do you some good to get properly drunk.
I might not be able to get properly drunk, Dream says, mimicking Hov's tone in an almost teasing fashion. He withdraws his hand from Hov's grip and leans back into his chair. The loss of contact feels regretful, but Hov's companion looks more content than Hov has ever seen him, and that puts a smile on his face. Dream thinks for a moment, then concedes.
But I don't suppose it would hurt to try.
Hov grins at him and calls for a waiter. It turns out, Dream can get tipsy with enough alcohol, which turns out to be a lot. They move their meeting to Hov's house and spend the whole day drinking, laying on couches, playing chess. Hov takes it upon himself to remind Dream of the rules and gossiping about politicians of the past. At some point, Hov falls asleep, only to find his companion waiting for him in a beautiful orchid, waiting to continue their conversation. He wakes up, grinning, refreshed, no hangover whatsoever. He decides that his dear, mysterious friend is the best drinking partner he's ever had. Hov doesn't see any particularly repeating doors in his dreams since then. He does see his friend, though. Dream visits him on purpose. Maybe 2 or 3 times a month. His visits are brief, only a small part of Hov's night, but they do get to talk or play chess or walk together wherever Dream leads. He shows Hov wonderful places, forests, oceans, mountains, orchids, tiny villages, and bustling cities. He says it is because he has duties there, which he needs to attend to later, but it feels like he's just showing Hov around his home.
If you ever decide you wish to stop living in the waking world, Dream says one time, looking at a beautiful view from the top of a mountain range to which he led them to. You are welcome to stay in my realm after my sister visits you. I would appreciate your companionship.
It is visibly hard for him to say the last part. Hov blinks at him.
You mean this is what I have to look forward to if I die? He asks.
Dream's lips press together.
No, he says. This is only one option of many. You may want to go elsewhere.
Hov thinks about it. You know me well enough to understand that wishing for death is not in my nature, he says after a long pause. But if it so happens that I die, well,
I can't think of any other afterlife I'd rather have. Dream looks at him, something vulnerable in his eyes.
Is that so?
He asks. Hov nods.
I would appreciate your companionship too,
he says, in a tone that suggests that he interpreted the phrase not as it was said, but as it was meant.
Your friendship is too dear to me to lose it, not even to death.
There might be a bit of teasing there, too. Hov is proud he now knows his friend well enough to tell what he truly wants to say.
Dream smiles at that. You are a menace, Hov Gatling,
he says affectionately, then turns back to the view. Softer, he adds.
I am happy to hear it.
Hov is grinning for a full day after he wakes up. This goes on for years. Dream deals with his problems without Hov's intervention, despite his reassurances and suggestions to help. Still, he comes to talk about his dealings if they bother him too much. He has to kill a Dream Vortex. He hunts down one of his creations, the Corinthian, and reworks another, Gault. He deals with his family drama as best as he can. He finally takes in a new raven, Gregory. He meets up with Death and, apparently, gossips with her about Hov. They meet once or twice a month in Hov's dreams, and three or four times a year in the waking world, for a dinner. Eventually, Hov persuades Dream to come to the theater with him. Then, once the movies come around, he takes him there, too. If Hov happens to be abroad, he invites his friend to museums and cafes, makes him try ice cream, persuades him to read books that Hov comes to love. Dream seems to comply with reluctance most of the time, but the more they meet, the more comfortable he becomes with Hov, and by extension, with humanity. Eventually, it comes to a point when Hov can swear his friend is meeting him not just out of loneliness or in search of relaxation, but to simply have fun. Although, of course, Morpheus looks quite stiff and composed most of the time, and dresses like something you might see in a fever dream. That's part of his charm, after all. Still, Hov learns to recognize certain smiles and glimmers in his eyes for genuine enjoyment and fun-having. In response to Hov introducing his friends to the waking world's entertainment, Dream introduces Hov to the residents of the Dreaming. Lucien, Gregory, a walking jack-o'-lantern, the Fiddler's Green, Cain and Evil, and their neighbors, Galt and others. Dream makes it seem like they keep bumping into these beings on their strolls across the Dreaming, but Hov knows better. He is happy to meet the family. During the Second Great War, Hov goes off soldering once more. Not for money this time, but because he genuinely believes in stopping the horror that spreads across Europe, paving its way with corpses and ash. He has his hard days and the nights there, but every time he feels stretched too thin, too tired, too pessimistic, his friend is there in his dreams, waiting for him with a beautiful view, nice food, and good conversation. Sometimes that's enough. Sometimes Hov wishes they could stop talking, wishes he was allowed to press his best friend into a wall and kiss him until there were no more thoughts left in his head. Other times, he wishes he could hide his face in his hands and break down crying. Appearances be damned. He doesn't. He doesn't until a month after the war ends. He comes back home to find his normal, empty life and finds that even someone like him, someone who's been a soldier, a bandit, a mercenary for dozens of years, even someone like that can still see things that haunt him in his waking hours, even if they don't do so in his dreams. One night, he dreams of his friend. They are sitting on a beach, Huff's trousers rolled up, his feet bare, only pants, suspenders, and an undershirt on him. Light breeze is in his hair. He can hear seagulls in the distance. The ocean is beautiful in the light of the setting sun. Morpheus is creating a new dream. He's taken to perform his more artistic duties in Huff's presence, a sign of trust, as Huff understands it. In fact, meeting Lucien felt like meeting family, and being around Dream when he works feels like sitting in a very private artist's home studio. Sometimes, Huff still wonders how the hell he ended up in this wonderfully crazy situation. "And what about you, my friend?" Dream asks, a philosophical inflection in his voice. "If you were to create a perfect dream, what would it be?" Huff thinks about it, or tries to. "A world where the last war never happened," he says quietly. "Where humanity wasn't as smart as we are, where we knew how to stop." Huff feels his friend's gaze on him, but doesn't return it. "And if you were to create a perfect nightmare?" Dream asks carefully. "That's easy." Huff chuckles. "Just to make them go through an attack of chemical weapons and survive." Dream comes to stand looming over him. "I was not aware you experienced that," he says. "I didn't," Huff says, looks up at his friend. "But I've seen those who did." Dream looms a couple seconds more, then lowers himself to sit down on the sand next to Huff, who turns back to stare at the ocean. "You never spoke about your hardship," Dream says. "I understand war to be a horrific memory. Would you like to speak to me of it?" Huff shakes his head, no. "I don't want to bring that here," he says. "I don't want to complain to you, of all beings. God knows you're doing enough already." Dream frowns. Huff feels it in the air around them. "I don't understand," Dream says. "Am I not a friend to you?" Huff turns to look at him, incredulous. "Of course you are," he says. "What's that supposed to mean?" Dream never initiates physical contact. Not in the waking world, not in the dreaming. This time, he looks at Huff's hand, pressed into the sand, hesitates a moment, then covers it with his own, cold and soft and uncertain. "Then speak," Dream says, "and I shall listen." Huff stares at him for a few moments, then sighs. "Fine," he says. It takes him a few minutes to find the right words, but when he does, well, he can't really stop after that. He talks and talks and talks about the friends he's lost, about how different this war is compared to other ones before it, about how horrific humanity's new inventions are, how sick their new ideologies get. He talks about tanks and fire and dead children. He speaks of hunger and the cold and the worst and the best people he came to know in these last years. He doesn't mean to cry, but his body doesn't really ask him at that point, so he gets a whole package of special effects, shaking hands, gasping for air, tears not stopping for what feels like hours. And his inhuman, raven-like friend who listens, as he always does when Hov talks for hours on end. When Hov finally calms down and wipes his face of tears and snot, he feels better. Embarrassed, guilty, yes, but better nonetheless.
"You are a brave man, Hov Gatling," Dream tells him, creating a handkerchief for him out of thin air. Hov takes it. "You've gone through much."
Hov blows his nose unceremoniously. He just spent the last 2 hours pouring his eyes out in front of the man. There is no dignity to lose, he reasons.
"It hurts because it's fresh," Hov says. "It's not the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I'll be fine."
"You are welcome to speak to me of this whenever you wish to," Grim says.
Hov smiles at him.
"Thanks," he says, then sighs.
"Sorry to be a bummer. You were creating a dream. I probably ruined the mood for that."
"On the contrary, my friend." Dream gets up and walks towards his creation.
Hov feels his absence almost physically, despite the fact that they didn't touch. Dream looks over this new being and waves over it, changing its features.
"I know what humanity needs now, more than it did before the war."
"What's that?" Hov asks.
"Hope for a better future," Dream says. "Dreams of the progress that unites humanity."
He looks at Hov.
"And perhaps a reminder of close friendships that can be relied on to achieve it."
Hov huffs, embarrassed. "All right," he says. "You're the king of dreams. You must know best." Dream smiles at him.
"Perhaps," he says.
They grow closer and closer and closer still. Years go by. They still meet at the same rates, if not more frequently. Sometimes, Dream doesn't show up for a while, solving one crisis or another. But he always comes back. Hov feels more comfortable about not only supporting his friend, but also to let his friend support him. They learn about each other's preferences in food, drinks, experiences, entertainment. For instance, Hov loves the movies. Dream prefers opera and theater. He likes live emotion. Hov loves tea and the beer, and Dream prefers coffee and the wine. Hov likes savory foods, and his friend can, on occasion, indulge in sweets. Hov takes his friend to a Metallica concert. Dream tells him that the fanbase looks
strangely, a lot like demons from actual hell. In 1989, they meet at their normal once-a-century meeting spot, only to find that it is closing. When they meet again, in a few months, it is at Hobbs' newly purchased new inn. They order wine and cheese and sit on the floor, since the place is being renovated and lacks chairs. It doesn't even have decent electricity yet, so they light it with candles. Hob feels his companion's gaze on him a few times during the dinner, but never catches him looking. Hob really wants to kiss him. This is the first time he cautiously suspects that maybe his friend would like that too. Attraction to dream of the endless comes to Hob in a form of a slow, simmering fire. At times it burns brighter, other times it calms until it's barely perceptible. It never goes away fully, partially because Hob doesn't want it to. His companion is the embodiment of hope and dreaming. It would be sacrilege to give up hope in being wanted by him. One evening, in 2018, Hob returns home late. He throws his jacket on a chair and keys and wallet in a bowl, phone on a dresser. He means to faceplant on the bed and sleep for 2 days. Instead, he enters his bedroom to find Dream sitting in a chair in the dark, eyes glowing creepily, his silhouette accentuated by the light of a window behind him. "Okay," Hob says slowly. "You look like you're here to kill me. Did I do something wrong?" Dream stares at him for a few moments, tension palpable in the air. He looks away. At this point, the stiffness with which he sits and moves is almost strange, reminiscent of the vague beginning of their friendship. Hob does not like that. "No," Dream says. Finally, his voice deep and hollow. Hob reaches to turn the lights on to see him, but his friend raises a hand before he can do that. "Don't," he says. Hob frowns, but obliges. "What happened?" he asks. There's a pause. Dream looks down before he speaks slowly. "My wife was captured," he says. "She was imprisoned and tormented for 60 years. I didn't know." That feels like a bucket of cold water. It is a lot. Hob takes a moment to wrap his head around that. At least the intense atmosphere in the room makes sense now. Hob recognizes it. It is the same feeling of quiet grief and rage he got from his friend when he found out the sire had had a hand in his imprisonment. "You have a wife?" Hob asks. "You never spoke of her." "I used to," Dream says. "She left. Our son died. That was thousands of years ago." "It still hurts," he doesn't say, but clearly means. Hob comes to sit down on his bed to face his friend. Dream's knee is almost within reach. Hob doesn't do anything about that for now. "Is she safe?" he asks. "Do you need me to help her somehow?" Dream shakes his head. Now that he's closer, Hob can see that his friend's jaw is set. "I made sure she was free," he says. The way he says it
implies that whoever did it to her has paid for what they have done. Hov nods.
There is a pause, during which Dream straightens his back and looks directly at Hov. An unsettling move, what with the lights in his eyes. His voice is surprisingly soft when he speaks.
Hov Gatling, I want you to make a promise. No matter what happens, no matter how our ways part or when, if you are ever hurt or imprisoned, promise me you will call for my aid as soon as you are able.
Hov stares at him.
Promise. Dream presses.
Okay, Hov says. Okay, my friend, I promise.
Dream nods.
He looks away, leans back into the chair, and breathes. His jaw is still tense, his eyes still glowing, his expression still full of barely concealed anger and grief, but the intense atmosphere in the room lets up.
Hov finds it easier to breathe.
Let me put the kettle on, he says, and moves to get up.
You clearly need something warm.
Stay, his friend asks. He sounds tired.
Please.
Hov sits back down. Dream breathes, purposefully, slowly, as if he's trying to calm himself. Hov doesn't see his face clearly in the dark, but he has a suspicion his friend is barely holding it together. He wouldn't have come uninvited otherwise, wouldn't have asked Hov to stay, because that's what the King of Nightmares does when the world takes him for a spin. He comes to Hov Gatling.
I'm sorry this happened to you both,
Hov says quietly.
I know it hurts to see those you love suffer something you've gone through as well.
Dream doesn't answer, only closes his eyes.
But you're all right, aren't you?
Hov adds, you are here. You have Lucien and Gregory and your siblings, and I'm sure many more beings I haven't met yet. Awful things happen, but we learn to come to terms with them and move forward. Your wife will come to be all right in time as well.
My entrapment doesn't compare to hers,
Dream says.
Not in time, not in humiliation, not in how she was treated, not in what she was forced to do.
Hov feels anger rise in him, too. He suspects what his friend means, and his hands itch to loose around some bastard's throat. Not because he feels bad for this particular lady. He doesn't know her, after all. He simply has a strong distaste for people who use their strength to violate and demean those who are vulnerable and unprotected. Gods, no. He remembers being on both sides of this, even if not in that particular way. He still remembers where some of his money came from, and he knows what being a pariah lets people do to you. Still, he survived both.
Then it will take more time, Hov says. But she will heal, and so will you.
They are quiet for a while, then Dream sighs.
Thank you, Hov Gatling, he says, for everything.
I'm here for you, my friend. Hov smiles, then gets up. Let's go, I'll make you something to drink. Dream hesitates for a second, then rises to his feet as well. He is thin and dark and sad. Hov really wants to hug him, so he does. This isn't something they do, ever. They don't even touch on accident, which explains why Morpheus goes perfectly still in his arms. When Hove wraps him into an embrace, it is almost uncomfortable. "This is the part where you hug back, Dream," Hove chuckles. He expects tentative hands on his back, or a strong and sudden squeeze. What he gets is a pushback. It hurts, but Hove can deal with it. It was a gamble, anyway. "No, you're right," Hove says, letting go. "Should have asked first. I'm..." He can't continue, because Dream of the Endless hands are on his jaw, and their lips are pressed together, and there is no air in Hove Gatling's lungs. It takes Hove a second to realize what's going on, mostly because the possibility of this happening was always in his mind, at a full stop zero. And then it's too late, because Dream is letting go. "Oh," Hove says, stupidly. Dream looks at his mouth, vaguely hurt, impossibly yearning. His thumb traces Hove's jawline, and it feels weirdly like a goodbye. Hove is having none of that. "Oh," he says, and grins, and takes his companion by the lapels of his coat. "You should have said something sooner, my friend." Dream blinks at him. "What?" he says, and then Hove is kissing him. It's less gentle than Hove imagined, but his friend isn't particularly soft, either. His fingers on Hove's face are strong, his lips' movements certain and driven by feeling. Hove wraps his arms around his companion's waist and presses them together firmly. Dream turns them around, and Hove feels the back of his legs brush against his bed. He leans away, severing the kiss for a moment. He catches Dream's eye. "You're not doing this because of your wife, are you?" he asks. "I'm not some weird substitute for her, because if so, you can fuck right off, my friend." Dream frowns at him, then smirks. "You fool," he says, and pushes Hove onto the bed, only to follow him shortly, his thin frame looming over Hove as he lays back and stares at the god of all dreams above him. "If only you knew." He kisses Hove again, but Hove doesn't go down that easily. He used to be a soldier, after all. He flips them over, Morpheus pressed into the mattress, him straddling the man's hips. "Then tell me," Hove demands. "I'm in no hurry." Dream stares up at him, stubborn and proud, for a long moment. Hove almost expects him to push him off and leave, but then something changes, and Dream closes his eyes and presses his lips together. "I thought you realized," he says, "and chose to ignore it. But now I see you were unaware of how I feel about you." "Is that so?" Hove asks, his heart beating fast. Dream looks at him. He raises a hand and touches Hove's face, unexpectedly gentle. "You are my home, Hove Gatling," he says softly. There is so much tenderness in that word that it hurts Hove's heart a little. He thinks about how gradually slowly his friend warmed up to him over the years, how much emotion he started to show freely, how much he's come to enjoy their outings, how many times he's come to Hove angry and grieving and a hair's breadth away from broken. Hove smiles at his companion. "I've wanted to kiss you since 1789, he says. "But more than that, I just wanted you in my life, no matter the terms. I thought you wanted me as your friend." I want you.
Dream says and draws him close and kisses him, gentle.
I want you.
Huff doesn't need to know more. In 2022, Huff works as a history teacher and pub owner with a full and exciting life. By day, he goes to school and acts like a cool teacher while trying not to go mad from the number of inconsistencies he finds in the school books. Then he goes to the new inn, has lunch, and grades some papers. Until dinner. Sometimes, a raven-like thin man joins him around that time. Then he, or they, retire to a small flat on the second floor of the inn. And then, well... Il est dans le bras de Morphe. The end.
Thank you for listening. This has been recorded for Katie Hart as part of ITPE 2022. I hope you enjoy.
Good places to hang out at. To hang out at.
If he had to put a hand toward the change. If he had to put a word to the change. It is 2 a.m. when they end up at Huff's place of residence.
Il est dans les bras de Morphe.
Fuck, I should actually Google how to say this copy. Dans les bras de Morphe. Okay, it's bad enough trying to get it in my own voice, but trying to make it in the slightly different tone of voice that I'm doing for Huff is getting to be difficult.
The Morphe.
You are welcome to speak to me of this. You are welcome to smick. You are welcome to speak to me of this. Huff's embarrassed.